Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. In this special episode, Lucinda Guthrie, Merger Market's executive editor, speaks to the co-CEOs of Eurazio, William Kadouche Chassan and Christophe Bavière, about the opportunities for private capital in Europe. During this time of geopolitical volatility, there's been lots of focus on Europe reasserting its sovereignty. They speak about how private capital can help bridge the funding gap created by today's challenges and discuss what a hidden champion is in the mid-market and where they see those hidden champions emerging.
So Europe is in an incredibly challenging spot right now. We have conflict in the Middle East. As we're recording this in the middle of March, there are, you know, potential for further tariffs. There are so many conversations right now about the future of Europe. So I'm delighted to have two fantastic people with me today. I've got the co-CEOs of Eurazio, Christophe Bavière and William Kadouche Chassan, who can talk to us a bit about where the opportunities and risks are in Europe, and also a bit about how Eurazio is dealing with these challenges. So let's start, William, right off the bat. We have all this talk about sovereignty. The need for sovereignty is so important right now for defence, digitalisation, but there's a huge funding gap. I'm interested to hear from you how private capital can play a role in this.
Hi, Lucinda. Thank you for that question. Europe, let's start with that, is a land of opportunity with a lot of strengths. It is challenged today in a fast-changing world of powers, and it has three dependencies: energy, defense, and digital. Private capital will play a key role in addressing these challenges, because the truth about Europe is that there is a strong set of savings. And there is also, because of the fiscal discipline in the past years, some room of maneuver at the state level. So we can fund the gaps that we need to fund in innovation, in defense, and also in adapting the energy grid for Europe. Private capital will play a role across the board in infrastructure, in buyout, in growth and venture equity. There are players who can channel that resources to key companies. There are a number of initiatives now that have been launched, particularly on the innovation. Let's focus on digital for a minute. This is probably where the more striking gaps is. There is six times more money available in the US for rounds of $100 million and above to fund scale-ups in innovation, AI, case in point, than in Europe. Now, you have a few initiatives that are starting to be put in place. One is Scale Up Europe. The Commission has decided to move forward, creating a fund of about 5 billion, of which 1 billion would be public money. The rest will be private money, and it has to be deployed by private capital. There are pockets of savings which we can reallocate in Europe to equity, both private as well as liquid. And they are quite significant. Most of the players in Europe at the institutional level, insurers, pension funds, are underallocated private equity. And infra is clearly an area where there are a lot of needs and money pouring in. I mean, look at what's happening in Germany now.
I've heard the phrase that, you know, we don't lack capital in Europe, we leak it. Because a lot of the savings or investments all go to the US. People sort of lazily allocate to the US still. So how do we ensure that capital flows remain in Europe?
In fact, the story is not so much that we fund the US equity. It's a bit more complex than that. Europe funds US debt, but the US fund European equities, which create in and of itself a dependency. Because when you have this money coming from the US funding the equity of innovative companies in Europe, obviously at some point, there is a risk that these companies may transfer their headquarters to the US, which, you know, often happens with people listing on the NASDAQ. And this is the result of rounds of fundraising that was backed more by US investors than European investors. The big leak of the European savings is not so much that this transfers outside of Europe, is that it is basically stuck in unproductive type of products like deposits. Deposits represent 40% of the 35 trillion savings posts that we have in Europe. In the US, it is 10%. And that means that in the US, because of the very structure of the savings, you have more money flowing into equities, i.e. funding development of companies and the real economy. That's the real endeavor. So what we have to do collectively is to convince Europeans to take more risk and give them the opportunity to manage this risk through bigger pension funds, through insurance money, and also through dedicated individual savers products with tax incentives and the relevant regulatory framework.
I think that's going to be a challenge. And what are you expecting on the regulatory side? Are there any shifts?
There are a number of things which are shifting today. And that's why, you know, I started saying Europe is also a land of opportunity. I think people realize that things need to change and that we need to tackle the competitiveness issue. The European Commission has set forth a number of proposals regarding the loosening of solvency rules for insurers to invest more in equities and particularly private equity. It has set forth a number of proposals to foster pension reforms across the continent, a bit on the model of what the Swedes have been doing in the past 20 years, and that has proven very successful to fund the real economy in Sweden. It has put forth as well some ideas regarding savings products that could be distributed at upon European level, etc. In conjunction with that, you need to make sure that the continent is a bit more competitiveness oriented. So there are a few proposals to foster the integration of the market. There are also interesting proposals to simplify the different things, such as the AI sandbox, as well as the very important 28th regime. That would be a very good leap forward, simplifying the creation of new companies in Europe.
You're talking about the creation of new companies in Europe. Another big theme has been around creating European champions, right? Now, I always think of European champions as the huge giant companies, LVMH, ASML. Christoph, you oversee the small and mid-cap buyout piece at Eurasia, among many other tasks. What does this mean in the mid-cap
space? Thank you,
space?
Lucinda. And on top of what William describes and the strong belief of Eurasia that Europe as a continent is full of opportunities. When you go at the micro level, the job of Eurasia is to identify small and mid-market companies that we call hidden champions and that have a unique potential, growth potential. We have identified five preferred sectors, energy transition, tech-enabled services, and when we mean tech, we mean cash flows, we mean business, financial services and insurance, sovereignty, and which one is the last one?
Because
healthcare. Obviously, healthcare is incredibly powerful in Europe. And once we have identified these growth candidates, we have the Eurasia engine. We have an engine, a growth engine, with four wheels, and we are helping this company to grow. The first wheel is buy and build strategy. You can help a local leader in Europe to buy its competitor and to become the European leader, potentially, the worldwide leader in its field. You can also help these companies to grow internationally. Some small and mid-market companies in Europe still have a regional leadership status. We need to help them to understand that growth is in Asia, growth is in Southeast Asia, all over the world. You need to help them to better internationalize their business model. Third, the third wheel of growth, we tend to believe that to help our portfolio companies to better understand climate change, to better adapt to climate change, and to better explain how they care about sustainability, help them to gain value, help them to reduce the risk. And last but not least, we are a strong investment firm in tech, in startup and in growth equity companies. So we are financing Mistral AI, we are financing some pure AI players, but we also tend to consider that AI is a tool to help companies to increase their profitability. So we help mature companies to better understand that innovation can also help. Once you take this unique hidden champions that Europe has, is full of. And when you put all these engines, all these wheels at work, you can create a lot of value for our final investors.
You mentioned Mistral, and I know you also are invested in Dork. How do you identify something like a hidden champion like that?
Well, first of all, we have teams all over Europe. We have teams, we started in Paris, so obviously we have teams in Paris, but we have teams here in London, very strong teams here in London, and all over Europe. We have teams in Sweden to cover Germany, which is a specific, it's a more decentralized country. We are in Berlin for tech, we are in Frankfurt for debt, and we are in Munich for healthcare and buyout. So we cover Europe as a whole. But what is, so our job is obviously to identify. But what has changed in the market, and what is a sign of maturity of the European market, is that, yes, the job of a good GP, of a good private equity firm, of a good private debt firm, is still to identify the best investment opportunities. What has changed in the market is that the market has matured in Europe, and now the very, very best investment opportunities, the very, very best entrepreneurs, they look at us, and they are selecting us to a certain extent as much as we select them. When you have identified a manager, a very good entrepreneur, rarely you are the only one to have identified them. But in most cases, you need to show that you will bring not only euro, but that you will bring help, resources, coaching, contacts to, and all these wheels that I was describing, a better usage of innovation. How can you use AI to increase your productivity? How can you use? We have offices also in China. We have half a dozen of people in China only dedicated to help our portfolio companies to get access to the Chinese market. We are not outsourcing production facilities in China. We are helping European companies producing in Europe to export their goods in China. And you were mentioning Dork. Dork is a good example of that. Dork is a leader in Europe about medical device for eye surgery. What can you do when you are the largest player in Europe in the medical device for eye surgery? You can't entirely have a monopoly. And so you grow as the European market is growing. You can try to expand in the US, and they have won 25% of the market in the US, but it's a mature market with also very good local players. You can also, because in China, what do you have? You have middle class, an aging middle class, as we have in Europe, and they are all suffering from cataract at some point of age. And we have helped Dork to meet 21 hospitals where Chinese eye surgeons are trained. And we have more than doubled the revenues of Dork by helping a European-born company to become number one in China. You may say it's a niche, but medical device for eye surgery, it's really a European strength.
I'm interested. I read in your report that there are so many challenges for European champions, potential hidden champions, ranging from across member states, you know, language differences. Also thinking about regulation, is there really a level playing field for European players when you look at the rest of the world? If you had a magic wand and you could change one thing overnight, what would it be?
magic wand, we don't have a lot, but there is something that people don't realize. Yes, Europe is complex. Yes, it's a unified market. Yes, it's not entirely perfect today. Yes. But never forget that European entrepreneurs, European managers, they are trained to deal with different cultures, trained to deal with different regulations, trained to deal with different languages. And so when it's about, entering, penetrating the Chinese market, Dork is already number one all over Europe. Dork is number one in every land, in every country in Europe regarding medical device for health surgery. I see in your eyes that, yes, it is a niche. But if we do, the future of a lot of European businesses is to become the worldwide leader where they are good at. And this is something where we tend to believe that the complexity, it is complex Europe, but the complexity of Europe is also a strength. Because when you go internationally, when you are European born, and when you go internationally, you are used to, and you are even better trained. If you are even the best middle-chain German company. But if you are very good in the DACH region, in the German-speaking regions, is it easy to deal day one with China? Not. But when you are trained to deal with the entire European market, when you are already a strong European leader, it's easier. And so we tend to believe that, to a certain extent, people are underestimating the strength, the knowledge, the expertise, the maturity of European managers.
With this idea, with this strategy of, building and growing these international businesses, I'm interested to understand how the geopolitics, the current volatility, is impacting the exit environment. I know you've done very well with exits. Even this year, actually, two already. But how does the geopolitics impact that?
Well, geopolitics is part of a broader set of factors that have created uncertainties. It started and very linked to geopolitics with the war in Ukraine in 22, combined with the post-COVID economic impact. That translated into high interest rates. That obviously was the first showstopper in the exit scenario for many private equity firms. Now things have stabilized. We know that the interest rates are higher than they were the decade before, but at least they have stabilized. Now you have other disruption. We're talking about geopolitics. AI is obviously one that is today disrupting the way people are thinking about the price of some assets, namely in software or business services. And geopolitics, of course, has an impact on how do you envisage the business model of some companies that are more dependent of some procurement chains, not to speak about, of course, the price of energy. So all that means people need to adapt to fast about what's going to be the development of the companies that they own in their portfolios. But also, it means that you have to be very selective at the outset that your company is resilient to different shocks. And that's probably what's happening today with an industry that is maturing towards identifying business models that look forward, that are fundamentals, where the fundamentals can sustain a constant volatility. So in the short term, we could see again in the first half of 2026, some impact from the current environment that has become stressed again for the reasons you mentioned. We have a number of wars, unfortunately, happening in the world today, an impact on energy prices, case in point. But overall, what we've been seeing in 24 and 25, in spite of these geopolitical issues, is an increase in volume because they are still very good companies. Macro data points in Europe, in the US, have improved in the past quarters. So this is not all negative.
And the core of your ASEO strategy is definitely to decorrelate ourselves from this general... can we entirely decorrelate ourselves from the general environment? No. But we can try to be as decorrelated as possible. And when you do what we do, when you do what we do, which is to take a local leader, to transform it into a much more efficient and fast-growing European leader, you can decorrelate yourself from the general environment. And this is exactly what William was describing. We have realized exits in 2025 at a level of back to our usual leverage levels, at our average level of exits at 20% of our portfolio. And this is mainly due to the fact that the companies we exited are incredibly good companies, demonstrating very strong growth trends. And it's when you are selling a company where the potential of growth is still in front of you, when you can say to the buyer there is still a lot of growth in that you can get an easy exit and a very good one. And so the job of your ASEO is definitely, we prefer when Ukraine is not invaded and when the Middle East is in a much peacier situation than today, obviously, on human and on financial terms. But the job of your ASEO is definitely, you know, one of our funds, it's only a dozen, a maximum of 15 underlying investments. So to make it successful, we need to have 12 or 15 very good growth champions. And this is feasible regularly.
By the way, geopolitics create also opportunities. The necessity of Europe to go back to your first question, to wake up and invest much more in defense, in technology, in energy transition, in healthcare, aging demographics. I mean, all these dependencies and challenges, fundamental challenges going forward, means that there will be markets for good companies based on this continent. And this is what we see today. I mean, one example, the dual use for a lot of companies that both on hardware and software space that is re-emerging thanks to increased budget in defense. That's a big opportunity for many companies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to come back. You mentioned the AI space earlier, William, and I know from your background, when you were at JP Morgan, I believe you had a TMT background, and obviously your ASEO has technology as one of the key sectors. There's a sense from conversations I've been having in the market that Europe's kind of been left out of the AI boom. Certainly when I've been in the US and in Asia, they feel there are these two ecosystems and Europe's desperate to get in, but they haven't managed to yet. I'm interested to hear your perspective. Where are the opportunities there?
Well, thanks for reminding that your ASEO is one of the key players in Europe as relates to venture and growth equity. We have a very sizable AUM invested in the field, more than 7 billion. And we invest our own capital. Eurasia always invests its own capital alongside investors. We are in biotech, we are in digital venture, we are also in growth equity, and we fight for this scale-up interesting, innovative companies that we were talking about. A number of them are already playing in the AI ecosystem. And one has to realize that this is a broad ecosystem and this is an evolving ecosystem. So the battlefield is only opening now. There are a number of areas where one may say that Europe has lost somewhat the steam and the opportunity. Hyperscalers, cloud, some of the hardware infrastructure. We underinvested in data centers, we underinvested in cloud in Europe, probably not something that will be easy to catch up with. But there are other areas where Europe has strong cards to play, and it's only the beginning. Large language models, I mean, most of the players are US and Chinese, but you have very good companies that have emerged in Europe. We talked about Mistral. Eurazeo is an investor in Mistral. This company is great. You'll have other areas that are in that layer, for example, in quantum computing. Europe, and by the way, France in particular, is very strong and has a card to play. I mean, this is deep tech, and we'll see in the future how the economic model works. But there, Europe has a competitive advantage. And then you have the application layer. Don't forget that at the end of the day, it's not just about having a powered infrastructure and an LLM layer. It's about having real use case for industrials, for consumers, for financial services, etc. And this will be the application layer. And there, Europe has proven to be quite strong. So we see a lot of companies that are interested, very interesting across the continent, north, south, east, west, including, and when we talk about the continent at Eurazeo in Europe, I have to say it includes the UK. There are great companies in the UK also in that space. And this is where there are investment opportunities, and we'll see who wins.
Just to complete what William was explaining, Europe has always had a good innovation skills. And when you talk about European engineers in the Silicon Valley, it's full of European engineers in the Silicon Valley. What has definitely changed? And it's a major change. And it is difficult to measure, but it's real. We perceive it every day with William in our daily life, is that today in Europe, you find very, very good European entrepreneurs, serial entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, and when they think about their, they don't think innovation, huh? They think business, they mean business. And when they think business, they think about global business. Innovation is not anymore a local market. It's not anymore a local market. It's happening to us every day at the same speed everywhere in the world. And Europe on this, we see plenty of incredibly good European entrepreneurs. That I must say is the reason why we are so optimistic about this trend. It's because we see them, we back them, we are doing business with them, and you know that usually it takes 5 or 6 years for us to go alongside an investment. So this is the major reason why we are today very optimistic.
And if you allow me, I think we should go beyond the AI ecosystem. I mean, everyone talking about innovation now is focused on AI, rightly so. This is a major phenomenon. But innovation pertains to many other fields where basically the battlefield is also more open. We're talking about nuclear fusion. Europe is very strong there. Everything that is linked to environmental solutions, patents for low carbon fuels, 60% of these patents come from Europe. You are talking about health tech. And medtech, 40% of the medtech companies in the world are German. You have biotech, where Europe has strong hubs in the Nordics, in Benelux, in France, in Barcelona. So you have to think about the innovation as something broader than AI. Of course, everyone is focusing on AI today, but there are many, many areas where the European entrepreneurs are interesting to follow now.
I'm feeling more optimistic. But I have to ground you a bit, and I'm going to challenge you a bit so you can give me in your white paper. Let me get the quote. In your white paper, you point out Europe is certainly hampered by a productivity gap and insufficient financing of innovation, the fragmentation of its internal market, excessive regulations, and the aging of its population. Now, I noticed in your recent results that you've increased your international investors. How do you make a case to an LP to invest in Europe right now?
You know, that's a very good question. Sometimes you meet internationally in Asia, in the Middle East, in the US, people that are more optimistic on Europe than some of the Europeans. People that are better aware of all the opportunities and all the strengths that we have in Europe than sometimes us Europeans are. And if I may say so also, what you can see is that to a large extent, institutional investors all over the world, they are fully allocated to private equity in the US, to private debt in the US and maybe also to infrastructure in the US. They may be relatively average allocated to the large cap space in Europe, but what we are demonstrating and what the reality of Europe is that a large number of people are still largely, largely underweight mid-market Europe. And Europe is a land of mid-market companies. And what will happen in Europe, the consolidation of mid-market companies, it's still a relatively fragmented investment universe, full of local leaders. What will happen to this macroeconomic raw material, if I may say it this way, mid-market companies in Europe, is that it will consolidate. The best players have to move from a status of regional leaders into the status of European leaders and eventually worldwide leaders. And to do that, one form of capitalism is very, very efficient. It's called private equity and private debt. So definitely a large number of people are realizing that they are largely, and sometimes some European institutional investors or private individuals are largely underweight on what is one of the strongest components of the real European economy, mid-market companies, unlisted mid-market companies.
There's no hiding that, growth in Europe has lagged US and Asia. There is no hiding that there is too much regulation and that the savings are not well allocated. We talked about that. And there was a gap in funding innovations, both at the venture and more importantly at the growth equity side. So this is what we basically said. What we see today, and that is interesting for many Asian, North American clients as a case in point, they realize it's a deep market. They realize that this is probably the best combination you can have between risk and yield, because this is predictable, because there is rule of law, because there is academic freedom, because there is a level of inequality that is the lowest and stability of society that is the highest in the world. They realize that the diversity of the opportunities, to the point of Christophe, about the density of SMEs, about the variety of sectors where Europe can play, leads to good yield. And that's the main point. When we come to our clients, wherever they are located, we make the point that the category in private equity that has yielded the most in the past 20 years, constantly, is European mid-market private equity, relative to public market and relative to the US private equity.
We've talked about LPs, but we've also seen the investor base broaden to the private wealth space. I think your retail assets under management increased by around 16%. I want to understand a bit from you about the evergreen space, because that I've been hearing lots of concerns about, with all this volatility in the market, what happens if everyone runs for the gate, and is this a risk to the private equity model? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Lucinda. First, Eurazeo has been in this business of offering private equity, private debt products to private individuals for close to three decades. So, and what have we learned? We have learned that the family offices, the very large family offices, they behave like international institutional investors, so they can invest in the same kind of funds. But to address the core of the wealth market, to address private individuals like you and I, like normal people, you need to adapt your product offering. And yes, we have launched, and we are very successful with evergreen funds. But when you manage an evergreen fund, you need to take into consideration who you are selling it to. First of all, at Eurazeo, we sell it largely to banks, insurance companies, network of independent brokers, but we sell these evergreen vehicles through life insurance contracts, through unit link. Normally, people who invest through a life insurance contract, through unit links inside a life insurance contract, they don't behave like traders, they don't have short-term views. They have a long-term horizon. So we are selling this product first. We are very careful about who do we sell it to. We sell it to very robust, very reasonable counterparts, banks, insurance companies, and networks of independent brokers. And on the other side, on the investment we made, we have two rules. The first one is that we keep a large proportion of liquidity. So currently, in our block, in our largest evergreen vehicle, we have 20% of liquidity. Gates are quarterly gates. Gates offer 5% of liquidity. So we are in a situation where we could offer, I'm not saying we are we want this to happen, but we are prepared to face a complete year of maximum withdrawing, maximum usage of gates. And on top of that, when you look at this quarter, the end of March 2026, the demand, the gross demand for redemption is 0.7%. And on top of that, we have subscription. So in net, it's obviously lower than that. So you need just to first clearly be careful, who are you selling this product to? People that are investing for the long term, that are savings for the long term. And on the other side, you need to keep a very strong proportion of cash. Some of our competitors, they don't do it. And on top of that, you need also to diversify a lot your portfolio so that one investment cannot create volatility. It's a very, very diversified portfolio. But the two rules are to know who you're selling it to and to adapt the way you allocate money inside this fund. You diversify a lot and you keep a lot of cash.
Is that in line with historical behavior, the 0.7%?
Oh, it's fully in line. It's a very, very robust behavior. Very, very robust. We have been managing this fund for 8 years now, the largest one we have. This evergreen. This is the most mature evergreen vehicle we have. On top of that, we are now launching new evergreen vehicles that are a little bit more specialized. Our Blockbuster is a combination of debt and equity, and now we are raising two more specific evergreen funds, one entirely dedicated to private debt and the other one entirely dedicated to private equity, because we perceive the market is maturing and at a European level, it's better to serve the market well.
So we're almost out of time, but I am like I've actually never interviewed co-CEOs before. So I do want to hear a little bit from you both about what it's like being co-CEOs and what the benefits are. William, perhaps you could.
It's like teamwork. This is as simple as that. You have to master your ego and always think about what is the best interest of the company. And this is how we make our decision, decide about roles and responsibilities, and basically make things happen.
And on top of that, what is important for William and I, and the signal we are giving to the firm, William and I, is that we are two co-CEOs. So there is a collegiality between us. And on top of that, we have a board, where we also, Sophie Flack. So, but it has, it's something that is that has inspiring the entire firm. Each one of our activity, so we have upper end of the mid-market buyout team, a private debt team, a venture team, a growth team, and we have organized Eurazeo in a way that today all these teams are managed by two, three, in some cases four people in a collegial way. So, and this is what we also perceive is a demand from LPs. The market is maturing in Europe. There has been a time for founding partners who were strong leaders, very independent and very individual. But there is a time now in the industry to adapt to more collegiality.
You know, it's interesting because there is also a generational element in your question. We are both over 50, so you know, you can see. People of our age would ask that question typically. I mean, how does it work? I mean, isn't it too constraining to be not to be alone? All the young people in our organization like it, and they tell us it's modern because they realize that, you know, in a complex world, you have to play as a team and you have to have complementary skills. And in reality, this is our day-to-day life. Two CEOs is better than one if you want to address a few issues that we have to deal with.
Does it help with the conversations around succession as well?
Listen, of course, about the succession of the CEOs is a matter for the board. I guess it simplifies when you have two options rather than one. But if you have to replace the two at the same point, it's probably more difficult. But you know, more importantly, it helps when we're talking about our teams, because then we can really challenge each other as to what is the best choice. We don't necessarily think alike on every topic. There are a number of topics we disagree, or we don't have the same perception, or the same way to think about it. So this constrains you to rely also on the advice of other people in the firm, just to try to make the right decision. And that is very fruitful.
And also, among the lessons learned, it has no impact on our agility when it's about when sometimes decisions have to be taken relatively fast. It happens. And so, yes, we discuss, but the experience has proven that when it's about taking a fast decision and it has to be done sometime, we are able, there is absolutely no difficulty to do that.
Have you ever had a time when you both did not agree?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
But and what we've learned is that the right decision is never the middle ground. The right decision is either he is right and you know, I accept that, or I am right and he accepts that, or someone else in the organization had the right ideas and we have to accept that maybe we didn't have the right idea. If really you strive to be agile and make decisions at the right time, you have to accept that. That's why you know mastering your ego is also something quite interesting to do at our age.
So I'm going to give you a couple of final thought questions. What is the most exciting opportunity in Europe right now?
Europe wakes up, and that's the most exciting opportunity.
I would say people tend to look at Eurazeo and say Eurazeo is gaining market share with LPs, with fundraising. What we are very proud of with William is that we are gaining market share in attracting the very, very best entrepreneurs. So again, very, very best entrepreneurs, the very best investment opportunities in Europe, they are more competitive to get access to. And we perceive that Eurazeo is the right strategy to be the go-to investment firm for these very talented entrepreneurs.
And one more, if you could pick one sector where we will get the next European champion, which one would it be?
Many else do you have? Because we see so many opportunities.
Maybe quantum? Quantum computing. I mean, I think we have really an edge.
I would say also, don't underestimate. We talked about five sectors. But healthcare, infrastructure in Europe. Do you realize the level of infrastructure we have in Europe? It would take me hours to answer to your question because we, at the end of the day, in total, how many individual companies do we manage? More than 600. So, and Europe, well, the beauty of Europe is that it's not only one area of success. It's incredibly diverse, incredibly rich. And this is the beauty of what we have. We have a mature economy, yes. We have an aging population, yes, but we have also the benefit of that. And the benefit is the diversity we are offering. We talked about the difficulties, different languages, different regulations. Yes, all this we know, but sometimes we overweight the level of complexity of Europe, but we are underestimating the number of opportunities, the number of good investment opportunities here.
Well, this is fantastic. This is the most optimistic I have felt about Europe in a long time. So thank you so much to William and Christoph for spending time with me this morning and hearing your thoughts. I leave this room feeling ready for Europe to wake up. Thank you so much.
That was the co-CEOs of Eurazeo, William Kudus-Chassan and Christoph Bavier, speaking to Merger Markets executive editor Lucinda Guthrie. And just to point out, this episode was recorded on Thursday, the 12th of March. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Markets. I'm Juliana Needham. To find out more about what we've been talking about on this episode, have a look at our show notes. Join us again next week.